so I close my laptop and open my pre-calc book. On Wednesday, Beck is absent from government again, and I'm beginning to think she's not coming back. I shoot her a text, but I get no reply. Still, I'm disappointed when I find the ramp empty. I sit down anyway, and I'm just starting to unwrap my burrito when I hear a familiar voice from behind. You're just racking up the tolls, aren't you? Chapter 16. I turn to find Beck standing over me. She's wearing a Cure t-shirt with the neck cut out, black leggings, and a plaid skirt that gives me Catholic school flashbacks. She's been gone for nearly 3 days, and she looks like she spent the whole time at super hot goth girl makeover camp. Her expression is, as ever, unreadable behind her mirrored sunglasses. Hi, I say. Beck smirks. First, she says, counting off on her fingers, there's the toll from last week. And then I actually gave you 2 juice boxes plus 1 for today. And I figure you've come looking for me every day this week. So honestly, at this point, we're way beyond Amazon gift cards and deep into narcotics territory. I hold back a smile. What makes you so sure I came looking for you? Beck drops her backpack and sits next to me on the ramp. She pulls her shades down and looks at me with those blue eyes. Riley, if I were to disclose to you the full extent of my powers, the shadow government would be here within moments to whisk me away in an unmarked black helicopter. Have you ever ridden in a helicopter?
No, I admit.
Well, let's just say that if I ever decide to tell you my secrets, I will need a triple dose of non-drowsy Dramamine in addition to the aforementioned narcotics.
I see.
Beck reaches into her backpack and extracts a 3-foot-long stick of beef jerky. I grimace. I take a bite out of my bean and no-cheese burrito, and for a moment we just eat in silence. So, I say, were you traveling with your dad? No, I was taking care of some family stuff. Oh, that's all I get? I want to ask where the hell she's been and why she hasn't called me since our date, if that's even what it was. And then it occurs to me, maybe she expected me to call her. All these thoughts lock up in my head, and none of them make it to my mouth. Beck extracts a juice box from her backpack. I heard you had words with the football team. I gape at her.
How did you know?
Everybody knows. You were like yelling in the middle of the cafeteria. I never yelled. Beck shrugs. Well, you made some waves. A wide grin splits her face. People are talking about you behind your back. Great. Not only have I failed to blend in, but I'm making waves. I swallow hard. What are they saying? Beck pulls off her sunglasses and considers me. They're saying how the new kid totally owned the couple from hell in front of everyone at lunch. I smile, though I suspect she's embellishing for my benefit. The new kid, is that all they're calling me? Beck shrugs. One person may have referred to you as that androgynous chick dude, but I slapped his hat off. My smile widens considerably. But listen, Beck says, narrowing her eyes. You should be careful. Jim Vickers is not a guy you want to piss off. I remember Vickers' look, and I suppress a shudder. I'll be okay. I'm friends with someone else on the team. Beck nods. Jason Solomona, a.k.a. Chewy, used to be one of us until Coach Terrence turned him.
Turned him?
Beck sighs and stuffs the half-eaten Slim Jim back into her backpack. You can't be on the football team and still hang with the freaks and geeks. Chewy learned that a long time ago.
Well, he's friends with me, I say.
Then why aren't you eating with him? I smile. Maybe I prefer the company of cute girls with lip rings. And then I realize that I actually said that out loud with my actual voice, and my stomach sort of ceases to exist, leaving a large vacuum where my guts were just a moment before. But Beck seems unperturbed by the comment. She puts her shades back on and says, "What are you doing this weekend?" My guts are back, and now they're doing somersaults. "Nothing," I say. "I mean, I'm grounded." "When does your sentence end?" "Saturday." "Perfect. You're coming with me to a club in L.A.
Oh, my God. She's asking me out again. I don't have an ID.
Beck laughs. "It's all ages." "I don't think my parents will let me." Beck puts a hand on my shoulder and leans in. Her face is inches from mine. I catch that scent again. Smells like vanilla, but with something spicy underneath. Warmth spreads through my middle.
Beck speaks, her voice soft, the beginnings of her words coming out in a purr. If your parents knew the crushing weight of your debt to me, and if they understood that coming with me Saturday night was the only way to repay that debt, short of acquiring nearly a metric ton of Schedule I controlled substances, they would say yes, Riley. I swallow. Beck doesn't move, just keeps her face close to mine, waiting. I open my mouth to reply, but something interrupts from behind me, breaking the spell. Hey, Beck, a vaguely familiar voice says. Beck leans back and lets her hands drop into her lap. I turn to see Eric standing on the other side of the railing. How can I help you, Eric? Beck says, her voice dripping with irritation. Eric hesitates, his eyes flicking in my direction as though he wishes I wasn't here to witness this conversation. He tugs at the hem of his sweaty shirt with a pudgy hand. Beck clears her throat impatiently and Eric finally speaks up. Can I have $5? He says. Beck rolls her eyes. Why should I lend you $5? He shoots me another uncomfortable glance, then looks back at his sister. Lunch, he says quietly. Oh, yeah, Beck says, and I could swear her face goes slightly pale. She plunges a hand into her backpack and extracts a crumpled bill. Here's 10. Eric looks at it. I really only need 5. It's fine, she says, waving the 10 at him. Thanks. He takes the bill, turns, and walks away with his head down. I look back at Beck, but she's focused on rearranging the contents of her backpack. I want to ask what that was all about, why they both seemed so uncomfortable. But she seems pretty embarrassed by the whole thing. And besides, asking about family stuff would open the conversation to topics I'd rather avoid, too. At least for now. Beck zips her backpack and looks up at me. So, she says, Saturday? Yeah. Yes, I say, then bite my bottom lip to stop myself from endlessly rambling on in the affirmative. Beck smiles, stands, and throws her backpack over one shoulder. Pick me up at 6. Where? I have explained all of this in the note, Beck says. What note? Beck produces a folded piece of notebook paper and leans over to hand it to me. As she does, the cutout neck of her shirt falls forward, revealing the gentle line of her collarbone where it meets the slope of her neck. She clears her throat, and I look up at her face. She smirks as I take the note, and then she turns abruptly and walks away. I sit down at my desk after school, intending to cram for my pre-calc test, but I can't concentrate. I have a date on Saturday night. I mean, I think it's a date. My face heats up at the thought of standing next to Beck in some dimly lit club, and I get out of my chair and start pacing my room. Will I have to dance? What should I wear? I curse, wishing I had someone to call who could give me advice about these things. And then I remember my blog followers. Statistically speaking, at least one of them has to have been in a situation like this before. I drop into my desk chair, open my laptop, and start to log into Blogler. But my fingers pause above the keyboard and I remember why I haven't logged in since Sunday. The trans girl at the train station. I have a sinking feeling that my advice didn't help, and that, if I log in, I'll find out she hasn't replied. And I'll know it's because she jumped onto the tracks after all. And then I remember the anonymous hate message and the cold smile from Vickers. Are they connected? Will another message, an even worse one, be waiting for me when I log in? I stare at the Blogler home screen, watching the little green frog logo catch animated flies with its long pink tongue. Am I one of those flies? If I log back in, will I get caught and eaten? I can't hide forever. Like Solo said, there will always be haters, but I can't let them stop me from doing what I want. And if I'm too scared to look, I might as well delete my blog. No longer feeling remotely like asking for dating advice, I log in and bring up my dash. My reply to the trans girl has gone viral. More than 1,000 users have liked, commented on, or reblogged my reply to her call for help. I click on the post and scroll through the comments. DZ boy. Stay strong, girl. We're with you. Anonymous. Hang on, sweetie. It gets better. Chi-town refugee. If you're in Chicago, you can come crash with us. Message me. They go on, an outpouring of love, support, and resources for the girl at the train station. My heart beats faster. I still haven't seen anything from the girl herself. Is she alive? In the hopes that she sent me another message, I click on my inbox and start reading. Mustang Girl 96. Please tell Anon I went through the same thing. She can message me. Expecto Patron. So brave. Please tell her we love her. There are dozens like this, and as I scroll through them, my fear dissipates. The impact of one anonymous hate message seems insignificant compared with this demonstration of support. Finally, I come to this message sent in the early hours of Monday morning. Waking up. Hi, Alex. I'm the trans girl who wrote you from the train station. I just wanted to say thank you so much for your reply. You made me feel like I'm not so alone. When the flood of responses came in, I totally started crying. I called one of the hotlines, and they told me about a safe house nearby, but I think I am just going to go home. I think if I don't, it will only make things worse with my parents. Anyway, thanks again. You kind of saved me. I put my hands over my face. My shoulders shake once, then once more. Two hard sobs, and I think there will be more, but they taper off. Relief surges through me. I wipe my eyes and read the message again, and then I reply. Alex, thank you so much for writing back. I'm glad you decided to stay. Please message me if you want to talk more. Hang in there. It doesn't feel like I'm saying enough, but I don't know what else to say. I click send. There's only one more message in my inbox. Mimi Q. Hi, Alex. My name is Mike Michelle Weston. I'm the curator of QueerAlliance.org, and I've messaged you once before. I don't know where in the world you are or whether you're interested, but we can always use contributors to Queer Alliance, or the Q as we call it around here. Send me a message if that interests you, or if you're near Los Angeles, you could always visit the center. Check the website for address and hours. By the way, in case you haven't realized it yet, I believe you found your cause. Mike/Michelle. My shoulders shake one more time. In a sob or a laugh, I honestly can't tell. I sit back and stare at the screen. I found my cause. Chapter 17. The next couple of school days are the best so far. Talking music with Solo before English, laughing with Beck on the ramp at lunch. I doubt I'll make the prom ballot, but I do feel like I'm finally settling in at Park Hills High. I practice speaking French with Casey Reese, and I even exchange civil nods with Eric. I have a couple more fluctuations at school, two on Thursday alone, but I'm less self-conscious about them, and I don't have any more panic attacks. I may not be blending in, but if I'm standing out, at least I feel like I've found a place to stand. Knowing that I have my blog community, even though it's anonymous and online, makes me feel like I belong, like I have a purpose, and that gives me confidence as I walk through the halls. I still endure occasional looks as I'm heading to my locker or standing in line for food, but for the most part, the people who don't like me just leave me alone. At lunch on Friday, I stop by the admin building to drop off the last of my transfer paperwork. When I walk in, I spot Jim Vickers seated outside the counselor's office. The sight of him elevates my heart rate instantaneously, and I almost turn and walk right back out. But then I notice that he's slumped in his chair, his shoulders hunched, his jaw propped in one hand. He looks defeated. He glances up as I approach the counter, and I can tell he recognizes me, but he just looks away. The office door opens, and a tall man in a beige sports coat emerges. His resemblance to Jim is unmistakable. This has to be his dad. He shoots Jim a sharp look and then heads for the exit. As he turns, I notice that he's wearing a white clerical collar, similar to the ones the priests at Immaculate Heart wore. Jim stands hastily and follows him out, looking like a dog who'd just had his nose rubbed in his own poop. I wonder what he did to earn that sharp look, let alone a trip to the office. Whatever it was, he probably deserved it. As I wait for the registrar to find my file, another thought occurs to me. I hope my own dad never has to make an appearance on campus. Having a preacher for a dad might suck, but it can't hold a candle to being a congressman's kid. By Saturday afternoon, I still haven't worked up the courage to ask Beck if our date is actually a date, so I decide to treat it like one anyway, just in case. I lie on my bed and pull her note out of my messenger bag. I unfold it and read it for perhaps the 10th time since Wednesday. Bullet hole. 12629 West Imperial Highway, Suite 7K, 6 p.m. Come as you are. I'm not sure what bullet hole is. I consider looking it up, but I'm kind of enjoying the mystery, and I have a feeling that's what Beck intended. The address is on the west side of town, in an industrial area maybe 10 minutes past the railroad tracks. But the final line is the reason I've reread the note so many times. 6 p.m. Come as you are. I run my thumb across the letters, which were written hard with a ballpoint pen. Come as you are. What could that mean? Maybe it's just her way of telling me that the club has no dress code. But something about it makes me think there's more to it. Does she know about me? The idea that she might have figured it out on her own brings me a fantastic sense of relief. But just underneath that, there's the fear that if she hasn't figured it out, she'll reject me when she finally does. I reread Beck's note 3 more times, trying in vain to find some secret meaning in the handwritten lines, some hint at what she might know about me, or about what she has planned for tonight. I glance at the clock. It's only 3. I have hours to kill before I pick her up, and if I don't distract myself, I'll spend the whole time poring over her note like a psycho. I think about Dr. Anne telling me I'm not crazy, and I wonder what she'd think now as I press the letter to my face to see if it smells like Beck. Nope, no vanilla, just notebook paper. Ugh, I've got to get out of my own head, think about someone else. Engage, as Dr. Anne would put it. Maybe she's right about this whole having a cause thing. So I stuff the note back into my own pocket, roll over, and log into Blogler. I hit the jackpot on the very first message. Kimmy G, 1995. Hi, Alex. I'm writing to you because I just found a box of girl clothes in my little brother's closet. He's 16. I've thought he was gay for a long time, and I'm totally cool with it, but I don't know how to talk to him about it. Anyway, I saw you're both in neither post, and now I think my brother might be gender fluid, too. What do I do? Tentatively, I start typing a response, referring Kimmy G to a transgender allies support group, but I stop. I sort of already know what they're going to tell her, and maybe my perspective could help this girl. So I delete my generic response and start to write what's in my heart. After a half hour of typing and deleting and rewriting, I come up with this. Alex. Hi, Kimmy. Your brother is lucky to have such a caring sister. That said, if I were him, I would be completely weirded out if my big sis told me she had been going through my closet. So don't start there. You don't know how he feels about all this. He could still be trying to figure it out. He may not be ready to talk. Hell, for all we know, the clothes might belong to a secret girlfriend. The thing is, he probably just wants to be accepted. Don't think of him as a kid with some kind of disease or disability. Just treat him like an equal. Don't walk on eggshells trying to figure out what's going on. There's no need to have the big talk. Maybe you could find subtle ways of letting him know you're open-minded about gender identity stuff. Mention a book or maybe a movie with a trans character in it. Make positive remarks. He'll get it. But the most important thing is, just be the kind of person he will want to turn to when he, or she, is ready. #genderfluid, #advice. I post it, and then I have a minor panic event in which I reread it 3 times and almost delete it. I sound stupid. Not at all as witty and charming as I sound in my own head. But I think the advice is right, and it feels good replying, reaching out. So good that I move on to the next message. Anonymous. Alex, thank you for writing that apostrophe thing the other day. I was having a horrible day, and I really needed that laugh. I wish I could be witty like that in real life when I get made fun of. Anyway, sometimes I get really depressed and just want to die. Reading your post made me want to hang on a little longer. I stare at that last line. It's hard to believe my joke made that big a difference. But there's something undeniably honest, even raw, about the message that resonates with me. I think about my own down moments, and how hard I try to appear happier or less broken than I feel. That's what this message feels like to me, the false cheeriness of a desperate person. Carefully, I type out a reply. Alex. Dear Anon, please don't think I'm witty IRL. I could never think of stuff like that in the moment. That's why I posted here. Seriously, I should rename this blog Clever Shit I Should Have Said. Thank you for being brave and sharing about being depressed. I wish I could say I didn't understand what you mean, but I do. Last week, I couldn't walk through the cafeteria without having an anxiety attack. Some days, I don't even want to get out of bed. I just want to pull the blankets over my head and let the void suck me down into its depths. But then I started sharing, writing this blog, and it kind of saved me. In a way, you saved me by reading it and writing back and sharing yourself. All of you did. So, there's something to remember. We're here for each other. We may be strangers on the internet, but we're real and we're here. If only we could all get together and form an academy for lost souls. The art department would kick ass. Academy for Lost Souls is the name of my new indie rock group. Hashtag genderfluid, hashtag depression, hashtag anxiety, hashtag suicide. I click post feeling gratified and honestly kind of fired up. Giving advice to strangers felt weird at first, but I'm starting to like it. It makes me feel like my own situation isn't so hopeless. It makes me feel brave. And maybe it's because I can't stop thinking about going out with Beck tonight, but my internal compass needle is absolutely pegged on F. Like, just the thought of wearing pants makes my legs start to feel plasticky. But I still don't know how Beck perceives me, and while I really want to present as a girl tonight, I'm really worried that if I'm too girly, I'll turn her off. So I have to go with neutral. On the other hand, I don't want to pick her up while I'm in a dysphoria spiral either, because panic attacks aren't exactly alluring. So, feeling a little brave, I decide to do a couple of clandestine girly things. First, I go into the bathroom and dig out the crate of unused styling products my mother has bought me over the last few years in an attempt to make me conform to her repressive 20th century hair values. By mixing a few of them, a waxy white substance and a brownish paste, I'm able to tame the cowlick on the top of my head and shape my shaggy bangs into a more feminine sweep. It's not a Hello Kitty barrette, but it definitely makes me feel more girly. Then I go back into my room and grab the unopened bottle of lavender oil my mother bought me from Mrs. Wells. It's supposed to be some kind of homeopathic anti-anxiety thing. And dab some on my wrists and behind my ears. It's super subtle, not too perfumey, but I absolutely love it. I press my wrists to my nose and look at myself in the mirror. My face breaks into a wide smile. I feel 100% better. My heart is beating fast, but in a good way. I'd bring up Bikini Kill's Rebel Girl on my phone, plug in my earbuds, and jump around my room like an absolute freak for the next 2 minutes and 37 seconds. At 5:30, I head downstairs to see my parents off. They're going to a dinner with some big oil company rep. Mom is in the kitchen packing homemade peanut butter fudge into an enormous tin. Dad is parked in front of the big TV watching himself on some talking head show. The interviewer says, "Your new education bill calls for massive budget increases. But just 2 years ago, you voted against a similar initiative. Can you explain that?" On screen, Dad smiles. It's his congressman's smile, but I'll be damned if I don't believe it. "Absolutely, Debbie," he says. "Since I cast that vote, I've visited over 50 schools in 10 states. I've seen what's happening on the front lines, and we've got to make some big changes." "So you changed your position," the interviewer says. He nods. "I know, I know. My advisors warned me against it. Said it was a bad move politically, but it was the right thing to do for our kids and for our country." Debbie steeples her fingers. "This isn't just another example of the famous Kavanaugh folksy underdog routine." Dad laughs. "Folksy underdog routine. That's good. I wish my team had come up with that." In fact, they had come up with it. I overheard that exact term being discussed during one of their late night meetings, and now the press is using it. Watching my dad on screen, I can see his charm working on the interviewer like it works on everybody he comes into contact with. On one hand, it makes me wonder if he's ever used his powers on me. On the other, I envy his charisma. Why couldn't I have inherited that? Dad flips off the TV and stands. "Sharon, if we don't leave now, the Ellises are going to beat us to Angelo's." As she passes me on her way to the garage, Mom looks at me and cocks her head. "Did you do something different with your hair?" I touch it self-consciously. Sort of. "It looks good," she smiles. "Thanks," I say, wondering which word was on the tip of her tongue before she changed her mind and said good instead. Once the Lincoln has pulled out of the driveway and turned the corner, I get in the minivan and type the address Beck gave me into my phone. I follow the directions to the industrial side of town. After 10 minutes, I'm as far west in Park Hills as I've ever been. I'm surprised and a little uneasy when my phone tells me to turn right into an industrial park that looks almost abandoned. According to the signs mounted above the rusting roll-up doors, the complex contains a trophy manufacturer, a furniture restoration workshop, a defunct t-shirt screening place, and several other now-deserted office warehouse suites. The last building is number 7, and I pull up behind it and stop the minivan. There's a red logo on the door, a tattoo-style drawing of a human skull with a hole in its forehead, inscribed in a circle of text that reads, Bullet Hole Studios. I hear a cacophony of drums and electric guitar issuing from within. I'm about to turn off the engine when the door to suite 7K opens and a tall, stubbly-faced guy in a red flannel shirt emerges and lights a cigarette. He spots me, then pulls open the studio door and yells something inside. A moment later, Beck comes out, toting a guitar case in one hand. She's wearing a black denim jacket over a white scoop-neck tank top, and my eyes linger for a moment on the exposed skin. She sees me through the passenger window of the minivan, and her mouth turns up in that familiar smirk, sending warmth radiating through my midsection. And then the tall guy reaches out, grabs her by the hand, and pulls her into him. She goes up on her tiptoes and throws an arm around his neck. He kisses her cheek. The warmth in my stomach goes instantly cold. Beck has a boyfriend? After a moment, she pulls away and punches the guy playfully in the gut. He parks his cigarette back in his mouth and waves her away. She approaches the van, stows her guitar in the back, then comes around to the front and climbs in. Hi, she says. Hi, I say, trying to sound normal through the knot that is now formed in the back of my throat. Hey, Beck leans toward me, concern on her face. You okay? Yeah, I say, faking a smile. Fine. Where are we headed? Pull out the way you came in and head back to the 57, Beck says, buckling her seatbelt. It's not until we're back on Imperial that I realize I've been holding my breath, and I let it out slowly. There's a long silence. That guy, he was so masculine. If that's what she's into, I haven't got a snowball's chance in hell, not on my most guyish guy day. But it doesn't matter because I can't choose to fluctuate, it just happens. I can usually fake it when I need to, mostly around my parents and for short periods of time, but for some reason when I'm with Beck, I can't. Something about her, something in her presence seems to short out my ability to pretend. Maybe that's why I like being around her. I should be making small talk, asking about her band or something, but all I can think about is my stupid sweepy hair, my lavender-scented wrists, and Beck up on her tiptoes with her arm around that guy. Hey, Riley, Beck says, shocking me out of my dark thoughts. I look at her, and she says, I'm glad you came. There's an uncertainty in her voice I've never heard before, a vulnerability, and before I'm really aware of it, the words are coming out of my mouth. Was that your boyfriend? I ask, heat rising in my cheeks. Beck blinks, and her mouth twitches like she's suppressing either a laugh or a frown. I can't tell which. He's my drummer, she replies. But you guys are, like, together. Beck cocks her head. People are not canned goods, Riley. We don't need labels. I tighten my grip on the wheel. What kind of answer is that? I want to press her, but I don't want to seem desperate or drive her away, so instead I change the subject. What's the name of your band? Fluorescent Sunburn. Oh, what kind of stuff? It's like late shoegaze, early grunge. Beck pulls out her phone and plugs it into the port on the center console. Is this you? I ask, gesturing at her phone. God, no, she says. I made you a playlist. I shift in my seat. She made me a playlist? Beck goes on. It's mostly Live Bad Religion for educational purposes, but there's some bootleg Pixies stuff too, since I know you're a complete pop whore. I gasp in indignation. I am not a pop whore, but I'm laughing as I say it. Please, Beck says, cranking the volume and rolling down her window. Ramones? Pixies? The Police? Your t-shirt collection is like a tour through the 80s. She glances over at me. You look hot, by the way. The skin on my face bursts into flame. My cousin has that, Beck says. What? I reply. The blushing for no reason thing. I glance over at her, and she twists her lips into that mischievous smirk that seems to set my guts on fire. All thoughts of the tall, stubbly dude evaporate. She made me a mix, and she thinks I look hot. My eyes linger on Beck, her hair blowing, her blue eyes bright in the glow of the streetlights, and I see that vulnerability I heard in her voice a moment ago. I'm stricken with a sudden compulsion to ask her about it, to break through this weird wall she seems to put up at random. Hey, eyes on the road, Beck says. I realize that I'm staring at her, and I turn my focus back to the road just in time to avoid drifting out of my lane. We pass under the freeway, and I turn and gun it up the on-ramp. The conversation comes in fits and starts, with Beck interrupting frequently to turn up the volume and scream over the music that I have to listen to this song. She sings along with such a complete lack of self-consciousness that when we come to a song I actually know, Where Is My Mind by the Pixies, I feel comfortable enough to join her. When we pull off the 101 freeway in Hollywood, we roll down the windows and scream the lyrics at the top of our lungs. Make a right, Beck says, breaking off from the song. A turn here, pull in the back. We pull into the parking lot behind a 3-story brick building. It looks like one of the older structures in L.A. Maybe 100 years ago it was an office building or a textiles factory. I park the van and follow Beck to a heavy steel door, probably the delivery's entrance. I don't hear any music coming from inside, and when I look around, there are only a half dozen cars in the parking lot. There's no marquee, no velvet rope, there's no line around the block. I turn to Beck. What kind of club is this? She bites her lip, making the little silver ring twitch. Don't be pissed, okay? I frown. Why are we going in the back? Have you not figured out by now that I like a little mystery? Come on. As she moves past me, she takes my hand as if it's the most casual thing in the world, and the goosebumps travel up my arm to the back of my neck, where all the hairs stand on end. Beck pulls open the door, and we walk in. It's an open space like the basement of an old store, with a concrete floor and wooden columns supporting the ceiling of exposed beams. A dozen folding chairs are arranged in a circle at the center of the room. The first person I notice is a large woman in an ill-fitting blue suit. Upon closer examination, I see stubble on her cheeks. She, or he, is holding hands with a slim Hispanic guy who looks like he could be an actor. Next to him sits a girl in combat boots, fidgeting with an unlit cigarette as she glances nervously around the room. Near the back wall, someone with short, vividly green hair is pouring water into a big electric coffee pot. From the back, I can't tell if the punk hairstyle belongs to a guy or a girl. Then, as I'm turning to Beck to ask her what we've just walked into, the most striking woman I've ever seen waves and starts towards us. She's well over 6 feet tall, lean and graceful, and even in the dim incandescence, her dark skin glows. She walks straight up to Beck, wraps her long arms around her like an affectionate octopus, and lifts her off the ground. Baby, 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 she says. Where on earth have you been? Beck's face is red when her feet finally touch the ground again. Just busy. Well, it's wonderful to have you back, the woman calls over her shoulder. Mimi, come look who's here! She turns to me. And who is our new friend? I wait for Beck to introduce me, but she doesn't. The tall woman bends her knees so her eyes are on level with mine, flashes a wide smile, and extends her hand. I'm Canada, she says, like the country, but with a K, and I am very pleased to meet you. She squeezes my hand with surprising strength, and that's when I notice that, from this angle, I can see that she has a very pronounced Adam's apple. I look over at Beck, who smiles at the dawning recognition on my face. Canada turns to Beck and makes a tisk noise. Is this a surprise party? Beck shrugs. Mimi, Canada yells again, glancing toward the back of the room. A tall, professional-looking woman in a cranberry dress approaches. I'm right here, she says, laying an affectionate hand on Canada's shoulder. Something about this woman is vaguely familiar, like maybe I've seen her on TV. When she recognizes Beck, she smiles broadly and embraces her. We've missed your sense of humor around here, she says. And then she turns to me and offers her hand. Welcome to the queue, she says. I'm Mike Michelle. Chapter 18. Time seems to freeze, and I stand there with my mouth slightly agape. After a moment, I sputter, Mike Michelle Weston? She raises her eyebrows. Have we met? We have, in a way. She sent me messages online. Well, technically she sent them to Alex, but of course she wouldn't recognize me. How could she? I've been to your website, I say. Canada laughs and throws an arm around her. Girlfriend is famous, she turns to me. What's your name, baby? I'm Riley, I say. It's very nice to meet you, Riley, Mike Michelle says. We're just about to get started. We make our way to the center of the room. I pick a seat with empty chairs on either side, and Beck sits down between me and the woman in the blue suit. Feeling a bit bigoted myself, I glance from Canada's prominent Adam's apple to the hint of stubble on the big woman's face. This club is obviously some kind of LGBTQ support group. which means Beck brought me here for a reason. She knows. When the realization hits me, I expect my heart to start pounding or my fingers to start tingling, but instead I let out an involuntary laugh of relief. If Beck does know, the fact that we're here together proves that she's already accepted me. My laugh morphs almost instantaneously into tears, and I hastily wipe my eyes. I shoot a glance at Beck to see if she's noticed, but she's deep in conversation with the handsome Latino guy and appears to have missed my mini meltdown. Mike Michelle calls the meeting to order, and the rest of the group take their seats. "Hello, everyone," she says. A handful of people say hello, and a few clap. "Welcome to Queer Alliance, which we affectionately call the Q. We're a gender and sexuality support group, and you don't have to fit into any specific category to be here. Some of us are gay, some of us are trans, and some of us are genderqueer. Some of us are out, and some of us aren't. This is a safe place where we share what we're going through. And tonight, we have some new faces, and some old friends, too." She nods toward Beck and me, and most of the heads turn in our direction. Beck smiles warmly. I give an awkward wave. Mike Michelle continues. "Let's start with our dedication." Everyone clasps hands, I take Beck's in my right, and Canada reaches out to take my left. Most people bow their heads and some just close their eyes. Mike Michelle looks up as if talking to the sky. "Tonight, we come together as a community. Not to focus on our flaws, but to celebrate our uniqueness. To share our pain, our joy, and our love, and to create a better tomorrow." Beck lets go of my hand as people start to applaud. Apparently, clapping is big with this crowd. When the applause dies down, Mike Michelle continues. "We'll start by going around the circle, but there's no pressure." Mike Michelle talks as though she's addressing the whole room, but I can tell she's speaking to me. "Feel free to introduce yourself, share something about your week, or just pass the conga along to the next person. I'll start. I'm Mike Michelle, the mediator of this group and the administrator of QueerAlliance.org. Even though my transition is complete, I go by Mike Michelle, because when I meet someone new, my name becomes an opening for dialogue, and that's what I'm all about." Her face splits in a smile that includes the whole room. "Okay," she says, "who's next?" "I'll go." It's the girl in the combat boots. She's sitting to Mike Michelle's left and speaks in a low monotone. "I'm Chris. I do IT at a big financial group." She makes eye contact with me, but only briefly. "For the new people, I know I look like a girl, but that's not how I identify. I started transitioning about 90 days ago. I have to live with being addressed as a girl all day, so I'd appreciate..." His voice breaks, and he stops. I catch myself staring at him, and then I look down at my lap instead. This is the second time in as many weeks that I've misjudged someone else's gender identity. I feel a pang of shame. Like everyone else, my instinct is to put people in a category. Chris continues. "Yesterday I was informed that my insurance will no longer cover my hormone therapy." The woman in the blue suit grunts in disgust. "You should sue," she says. "I'll take the case myself." Chris shakes his head. "Companies don't have to fund birth control if it goes against their moral values. They argue the same for transition treatment. I just..." Chris buries his face in the crook of one arm. "I can't go back there. The way they look at me..." His speech dissolves into sobs. I sit back in my chair and stare at my hands. My problems suddenly seem small, even ridiculous compared to this man's. I glance around the group. Everyone, Beck included, is watching Chris with expressions of empathy and concern, and I start to feel like I'm intruding, like I shouldn't be witnessing this stranger's vulnerable moment. Once Chris has composed himself, he goes on. "I'm going to start looking for another job. And I'm not stopping therapy. I'll just have to figure out how to pay for it out of pocket." The group applauds him, and he accepts their acknowledgement with a teary smile. The big woman in the blue dress volunteers to share next. She introduces herself as Benny and says that she identifies as a trans woman. After 20 years of hiding, Benny explains, she finally came out to her wife, who promptly filed for divorce. Now she's going through hormone therapy and struggling with the accompanying weight gain. Herman, the tall Latino man, is Benny's straight, cis male boyfriend. When they met at a law conference last year, Benny was still presenting as a man. But Herman somehow saw past that and they fell in love. It's a beautiful story and they laugh as they take turns retelling it. A few times I find myself glancing at the person with the short green hair. She, or he, looks to be around 25, has very fine features, and doesn't appear to be wearing any makeup. A puffy green flight jacket obscures the more telling parts of his or her anatomy. At one point, our eyes meet, and I look away, embarrassed. Beck goes next. She says hi and that it's good to see everyone, and that's when I wonder, how does she even know about this place? She seems to know everybody by name as though she's been here dozens of times before. What am I missing? And then it's my turn to talk. Mike Michelle says I shouldn't feel pressure to say anything, but I do. After hearing everyone else share their most personal thoughts, I feel like I owe them something. As the eyes turn toward me, my heart starts to beat faster and the saliva seems to evaporate from my mouth. After a long, uncomfortable silence, Canada takes mercy on me by launching into a story about her daughter. I'm not really listening. I'm too busy trying to control my breathing, but I'm grateful for the rescue. Eventually, the formal go-around-the-circle format dissolves into a more open discussion. As everyone shares what's happening in their lives, I start to feel more normal. I feel lucky to have figured myself out at 16 instead of waiting until I was married with kids. Some of these people grew up without the internet. They had no way of reaching out, no way to find out why they felt the way they felt, or even to discover that it had a name. At one point, Mike Michelle invites the member with the green hair, who apparently goes by Morgan, to share. But Morgan graciously declines in a soft, alto voice. By the time Mike Michelle calls the meeting to a close, reminding the regulars that next week's session has been rescheduled for Friday, I already know I want to come back. It's 10:15 when we pull out of the parking lot and then make a right on Sunset. Traffic crawls along the boulevard. Even the sidewalks are full of life, but I don't really see any of it. Every part of my brain not required to operate the minivan is trying to make sense of the last 3 hours. What kind of second date was this? Or was it a date at all? Furthermore, how did Beck know about the queue, and why does she seem to know all of its members? I want to ask her 100 questions. Hey, Beck says, you okay? Yeah, just thinking. Beck adjusts her seatbelt and turns to face me. You were pretty quiet at the meeting. I shrug. I wasn't really prepared for that kind of thing. I know, Beck says. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have surprised you like that. She glances out the windshield, gently punching her thigh with a fist. I have an overdeveloped sense of drama. You say that like a person with an overdeveloped sense of drama. She laughs. It's okay, I say. Really, I just didn't know what I was walking into. See? Mystery. Not a bad thing. She smiles, and I smile back. So how did you know about that place? I ask. Beck turns away, maybe to look out the window or maybe to avoid my gaze. Beck? After a long silence, she turns to face me again, and that crooked smile is back on her face. That's not really second date material, she says. Second date? Fireworks go off in my midsection, questions rush to the top of my mind, but before I can ask any of them, Beck says, Wait, where are we? Did you already pass San Vicente? I shrug. I have no idea. Oh, great. Hang on. She pulls out her phone and checks the map. Okay, turn right up here on Larrabee. Just as I pull into the intersection, Beck shrieks and starts pointing frantically out the driver's side window. I almost drive off the road. Look. Look, it's... Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's... Look, it's him! But I can't look because I'm trying to pull the van back into my lane while simultaneously recovering from a minor cardiac event. Jesus, what? Who? Him with the... from the... band! Who? The guy with the... Dave! Standing right outside the Viper Room. Dave Grohl. Foo Fighters Dave Grohl? Yes, yes, right there! She's unbuckled her seatbelt and is now hanging out the window. Do you want me to stop? She drops back into her seat and gapes at me. Stop? Oh, God, no. What would I say? Just keep driving. I glance into the rearview mirror just in time to see the faint green glow of the neon sign, and then it passes out of view. Beck sinks into the passenger seat, taking deep breaths. So, Dave Grohl, huh? I think of that flannel-wearing drummer kissing her cheek. Really? That's your type? Beck refastens her seatbelt and rolls up her window. Don't be ridiculous. I don't have a type. And even if I did, Dave Grohl transcends all sexual boundaries. I guess, I say, feeling a twinge of jealousy. You look like you were having a fit back there. Ugh, I know, I can never spit out words when it's important, Beck says. Like, I was at the zoo once with my sister when I was a kid, and we were standing outside the monkey enclosure, and she was just staring through the bars at these two adult spider monkeys who were, like, picking fleas off each other and eating them or whatever, but she didn't see the baby monkey hanging right above her with a handful of poo about to fling it. And you'd think I would be able to yell, "Sister, beware, monkey poo from above," or "incoming at least." So you didn't warn her? No! All I could muster was, "Monkey! Monkey! Monkey!" But it was too late. Splat. No. Yup, she took a load of monkey dung right in the skull. Ugh, we couldn't shampoo all of it out. We had to cut off so much of her hair. I laugh, and Beck does too. But the laughter fades quickly, and the silence rushes in to fill its space. Beck looks out the window again. After a moment, I sort of blurt, "How did she die?" Beck doesn't reply right away, and I'm afraid I've gone too far. "I'm sorry," I say. "You don't have to answer that." "It's okay," Beck says, and I believe her. She had a bad reaction to some medication, and they couldn't resuscitate her. "Oh, God, Beck, I'm so sorry." It's not enough, but I don't know what else to say. Beck nods and then falls quiet, and I pull onto the freeway. The traffic is horrible, and we inch our way through downtown at about 15 miles per hour. Beck reaches over and turns on the stereo. Bad Religion breaks the silence, and for a while we just listen. Finally, I reach over and turn down the volume. "So, how come you don't sit with the hardcores anymore?" Beck turns to me.
"The who?"
"Oh, yeah, sorry, I sort of nicknamed your table the hardcores."
"The hardcores, that's funny."
Her smile fades a little. "But it wasn't my table. You said sometimes you need a day off, but that was like a week ago." Beck turns to look out the window. "People are okay one-on-one, but get them into groups and they start adopting this hive mind. Like we all have to like the same band and buy the same brand of hair dye." She hasn't answered my question, any of my questions really, but I decide not to push it. I'm enjoying her company and I don't want to spoil that. The conversation ebbs and flows. We talk about music. We like a lot of the same bands, but mostly we avoid talking about the big issues. Sex, family, stuff like that. It's a pretty superficial conversation, to be honest, but I sort of don't care. With her, even the surface stuff feels, I don't know, deep, alive. The traffic breaks up just south of Hollywood. Downtown recedes behind us, and before I know it, we're back in Park Hills, pulling off the 57. "Should I take you home?" I say. "Nah, just back to Bullet Hole." I pull up at the studio and kill the engine. We sit there for a while, neither of us moving or talking, just sitting and breathing. I sense more than see her hand resting on the center console. It seems to have its own magnetic pull, drawing my hand toward it. I release my death grip on the steering wheel and let my right hand fall gently into my lap. Then, slowly, I inch my arm toward the console. "I'm glad you came," Beck says.
"Me too."
I take a slow breath and then reach for Beck's hand, but at the same moment she turns and grabs the door handle. I waited too long. I put my hand back on the wheel and look away. "So," Beck says, "you want to do this again next week?" My breath quickens and I turn to look at her. I want to scream, "Yes, yes, yes," but instead I say, "Yeah, that would be good." And then the van door opens and Beck hops out, grabs her guitar from the back, and slams the sliding door shut. She waves, crosses the parking lot, and disappears into the studio in a swell of crashing cymbals. I get home 30 minutes before curfew. As I pull into the driveway, the light goes out in my dad's den. He waited up for me. I kill the engine and head inside. Lying on my bed, my laptop whirring to life next to me, I stare up at the ceiling and just breathe. I feel like a completely different person from when I left the house just a few hours ago. The kind of person who drives to LA with a hot girl on a Saturday night. The kind of person who lies to their parents and goes to support groups and tries to make a move on said hot girl in a parking lot with live punk rock thundering through the walls. A few butterflies still twitch in my stomach and I savor the delicious discomfort. I wonder how things might have gone if I had reached for Beck's hand just a moment sooner. Would we have kissed? What would her lips feel like? At this thought, the butterflies flap up a hurricane. But kiss or no kiss, she still asked me out on a third date. A slow, triumphant smile spreads across my face. My laptop emits its welcoming chime, informing me that my immersive online experience is only moments away. I roll over onto my stomach and log in.
When my dash pops up, my jaw drops. Followers 10,161. I stare at the number for a solid minute, not moving a finger. From 500-something to over 10,000? How the hell could that even happen? It has to be a glitch. I click refresh. The page goes white and then comes back to life, but the numbers remain the same. I expect a swell of excitement to rise within me. Instead, I feel a wave of cold dread that drowns whatever butterflies remain. I click on the envelope icon. I have hundreds of messages. I start scrolling through. Yellow bedwetter. OMG, have you seen the article? Queer boy, 1996. Guess you're gonna be Blogler famous now, winky face. Anonymous. Alex, I can't believe you responded to that kid. Way above your pay grade. You're responsible for what happened, and I hope they prosecute you. My panic rises as I skim message after message that makes reference to some news story. I have to scroll through a dozen before I find one that includes a link to the article. I click it and begin to read. Transgender teen survives alleged assault by father. Nicholas Price, special contributor to The Advocate. Norman, Oklahoma. An Oklahoma teen sustained a severe beating by her father after coming out as a transgender girl to her parents on Sunday, police said. She was treated for a fractured jaw, two broken ribs, and multiple cuts on her face and arms at Oklahoma University Medical Center and was released early Monday. Her father, Douglas Gingham, 42, was arrested on suspicion of assault and is being held at the Cleveland County Jail, Norman Police Department Sergeant John Harmonson said. The alleged attack reflects a growing trend of violence inflicted on U.S. teens who reveal their non-conforming gender identities to family or classmates. While it is the Advocate's policy to conceal the identity of minor victims, Andrew, Andy Gingham, requested that her name be used, with the permission of her mother, and that her story be told to put a human face on the issue. "When I told them, my dad hit me in the face," says Gingham, 17, "so I just left." That was when Gingham said she reached out online. She sought the advice of a gender-fluid blogger named Alex, whose diary-cum-advice column, Hiding and Other Social Skills, blogler.com/Alex, has been gaining popularity in the LGBTQ community. "That blog saved my life," Gingham said. "When I left my parents' house, I was lost, ready to end it. But then Alex responded, and just knowing that one other person out there knew what I was going through and cared enough to write back made me stop." Click here to read the original blog post. Gingham said she didn't sustain her severest injuries until she returned home in a second attempt to reconcile with her parents. That was when the beating ensued, police said. "Dad had been drinking," Gingham said. "He just lost control." Gingham's mother was eventually able to calm her husband and call an ambulance, Harmonson said. Neither of Gingham's parents was available for comment. Despite the severity of her situation, Gingham remained hopeful about the future. "If I can live through this, I can live through anything," Gingham said. "It's time for all of us to come out, trans girls and trans boys and everybody. The longer we hide, the more of us will get hurt every day. I don't want to be part of that anymore." Gingham spent the night at Oklahoma University Medical Center before being transferred to a Child Protective Services facility in Oklahoma City, but said she expects to be returned to her mother after a closed hearing later this week. I read the story twice, and by the time I'm finished, my face is tingling. She listened to me. And she got beaten for it. In the next moment, I'm overcome by an ironclad conviction that the link is a fake, that this is some kind of elaborate prank. Hastily, I Google the headline, but sure enough, the Advocate story comes up as the first search result. I go to Queer Alliance. The article is the top story, along with a special profile on my blog, including my now notorious David Bowie avatar. Finally, I open a new browser window and go directly to the Advocate's website. Andy Gingham's story isn't on the homepage, but I find it after only a few clicks. I stare at her photo, and it feels as though a hand is squeezing my heart. My eyes blur, and then the tears spill out, running down my face. Her father beat her. She went back, and he beat her. I stand up, start to close my laptop, then sit back down again. I clap a hand to my chest as if I can somehow slow my heartbeat from the outside. I take a deep breath. I'm not responsible for her injuries, of course I'm not. But I'm not innocent either. I got involved. It may not have been my fist that beat her, but my words left their own marks. Very real, very tangible marks. But Andy didn't blame me. She thanked me.
This can't be my life. It feels like I'm watching it happen to someone else. And yet I know it's real, I know it's true. And what started out as a half-assed attempt to appease my doctor has now affected someone's real life, and potentially the lives of 10,000 other people who read what I wrote. It's too much. It's too big, I can't wrap my mind around it. I click over to my inbox and start skimming through again. Many of the messages are from transgender people, adults and teenagers, expressing their sympathy for Andy and praising her courage. The others are directed toward me, and they're split more or less evenly between support and criticism. DocMama82 tells me in raging capital letters that I'm unqualified to give advice to anyone, while OutGuy in Denver states I should pursue therapy as a career. One anonymous sender claims Andy wouldn't have been beaten if it weren't for me, but another insists I prevented her suicide. But it's the message from DanielD87 that gets to me. DanielD87. Wow. I almost came out to my dad because of what you wrote to that girl, but I changed my mind at the last second, and now I'm glad I did. I'm not ashamed of what I am, but I'm sorry. If coming out is going to get me beat or kicked out of my own house, then it's not worth it. I'd rather stay in the closet. Tears blur my vision a second time. I'm enraged at Andy's father for hurting her, and I'm angry at DanielD87 for letting his fear keep him in the closet. But mostly I'm ashamed. Ashamed that, just like Daniel, I'm too afraid to come out myself. Ashamed that I've been hiding behind this fake name, pretending to be some kind of counselor, some kind of activist, when the truth is, I can't even face my own problems. I'm only a scared kid, just like Andy was. I read the rest of the messages. All of them. I take particular satisfaction in the hateful ones. Reading them hurts, and the hurt feels like punishment. Punishment that maybe I deserve. Finally, I come to the last message in the inbox. I click it, and I freeze. Anonymous. See you at lunch, fucking tranny. Chapter 19. The next few days go by in a dark haze. My sense of belonging seems to evaporate along with my confidence. Sierra Wells glares at me when I walk into AP English, and Cole, Vicker's stringy-haired teammate, grabs his crotch at me as I pass him on my way to my locker before pre-calc. I try not to let it get to me, but it does. In fourth period, Casey Reese tries to cheer me up, but I brush her off. I just want to be left alone. I have vague, humorless conversations with Solo, and when he asks me what's wrong, I just shake my head. Beck shoots me concerned looks, but she doesn't say anything. Maybe she's trying to give me space. It's hard to tell because I feel so detached, like everything is unreal and I can't seem to relieve the pressure that's settled on my chest. See you at lunch, fucking tranny. The message plays over and over in my mind, and instead of paying attention in class, I'm compulsively trying to puzzle out who sent it and why. I figure it comes down to two scenarios. Number one, the message is an empty threat by a stranger. It contains no names, no places, no specifics, just a vague see you at lunch. But everyone eats lunch, so while it's reasonable that I immediately think of Vickers and his gang because they've been harassing me in the cafeteria, there's no actual evidence to suggest that they're involved.